Blog Talk Radio.
Beyond the Blue Club. I'm your host, Charles Williams. I'm joined by my lovely wife, Jalavette. Say hello, Jalavette.
Hello, Jalavette.
All right. We have a great program for this evening. We're beginning a series of discussions with Dr. Jeffrey B. Perry. He's the author of the Hubert Harrison Voice of Harlem Radicalism. And I want to tell y'all more about Dr. Perry. He is an independent working-class scholar, formerly educated at Princeton, Harvard, Rutgers, and Columbia. His work focuses on the rise and the role of white supremacy as a retardant to progressive social change and on the centrality of struggle against white supremacy to progressive social change. For 40 years, Dr. Perry has been active in the working-class movement as a rank-and-file worker and as a union shop steward officer, editor, and retiree. He has also been involved in domestic and international social justice issues, including affirmative action, union, democracy, and anti-apartheid, anti-war, and anti-imperialist work. And without further ado, welcome, Dr. Perry.
Hi. Thank you, Charles Jolivet. Thank you so very much. It's an honor to be on the show.
Thank you for joining us. I was very excited when I first heard many of your lectures, and some of the ideas that you shared are very, very intriguing and thought-provoking, and I was very excited to have an opportunity to have you be a part of the African Knowledge Beyond the Book Club.
Fine. I really appreciate. And I do want to point out, although I started writing on Hubert Harrison in the 1980s, there had been people who have been keeping his memory alive: Richard B. Moore, Joel A. Rogers, John G. Jackson, John Henry Clark. I mean, people your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with, and they had done some important work in keeping his memory alive.
Now, thank you. You know, I was more talking for us that just black education. We hear all about Booker Washington and Du Bois to death. You know, I didn't mean to say that no one had written about it. I said largely ignored, because when you go to school, and nobody's talking about Harrison, but they're talking about Booker Washington, Du Bois to death, and that's just the dichotomy of black intellectualism, the only dichotomy that exists. But really, it's more diverse than that. Even John Henry Clark is even ignored amongst mainstream black education. But until you people, I guess you have to grow outside or get some further exposure. And find out there's so much, more to be understood about what has been discussed or thought. For instance, you brought about, how did you get involved? How did you get interested in Hubert Harrison?
All right, I'll try and keep it short. So if I go off a little bit, just pull me in, okay? But I'm a product of the 60s, and like millions of other people in this country, I was deeply affected by the civil rights, black liberation struggle, and so many people in so many ways those movements affected people, because, I think two reasons I usually emphasize: because the cause was just, and because it was hitting so directly at how the ruling class maintained control in this country. So I was influenced by that, and I started to get active in the late 60s. I was born in 1946. And I went into a big 4,000-worker postal facility up in Jersey City outside New York in the area where I lived, right, working-class community, and was very active there as a rank-and-file activist and shop steward, and later, headed the union there. And while doing that, I decided I wanted to write a little more about efforts, previous efforts by labor and left people to try and push for social change, And I was doing so from the perspective that white supremacy was central to understanding why these movements had not been more successful. And in that, I was influenced by the work of Theodore W. Allen, who perhaps we can mention later, who wrote The Invention of the White Race and pioneered a lot of analysis that's very important. All of this stuff is on my webpage, by the way, www.jeffreybperry.net. So, to get to the nub, I'm writing and researching. I'm working full-time, but I'm also, I decide to go back to school, to graduate school. And I'm writing on efforts at social change and how the left had been undermined by white supremacy. And then I come across up at the Schomburg Center in New York, which is the public library, a major research facility in black history and culture, founded by Harrison, actually, and his friend Arthur Schomburg and others. And I found two books on microfilm. This is how we used to access it way back then. And I printed them out, two of Harrison's books, The Negro and the Nation, written in 1917, and When Africa Wakes, written in 1920. And I read those books, and I stopped everything I was doing, because I was very familiar with all the literature of the early 20th century on the left and everything. And Harrison, Hubert Harrison, was head and shoulders above all his contemporaries, I thought, in terms of the clarity of his analysis, his understanding, truly brilliant. He wrote brilliant in a brilliant way. And so I started, and I'll wrap this section up soon, I started researching, and I tried to find more information on him because there was a limited amount of information available. And back then, computers were still in their infancy a little, but you could take the same email and change the who it's going to. It was a big innovation. So I sent emails all over to these librarians and old-timers. And a librarian from the Virgin Islands wrote back and said she was related to the family and his son and daughter were alive up in New York area. So in the early 1980s, I met his son and daughter, who were still alive, daughter Ada and son William. And I came to them with a few hundred pages. I said, listen, I'm interested in writing on your dad. And, you know, she was a school principal and he was a lawyer. These are very bright people, knew their history, right? And they look at me and say, what do you want to write about my dad for? So I left my material with them. And on the third visit, they took me into the front room in this Harlem railroad flat, kind of railroad apartment, and they had preserved all his papers since 1927 when he died. Harrison lives from 1883 to 1927. So they had preserved all his papers, and they showed great confidence and trust in me. I was overwhelmed, right? And they said, do with these what you need to do. So, very briefly, what I did is I loaded them all up. I took a few trips. I brought them back, and I became an archivist overnight. I got the acid-free paper and the Mylar and the archival boxes. And then over the next 20-plus years, while working full-time, I would come home every day and index and inventory these documents, you know, get them all organized. I made copies originally, so I never had to deal with the originals anymore, right, because I knew how important they were to preserve. Now, to make that story a little short, so that's how I started, but the papers, Harrison's actual papers, after the children passed away, the grandchildren came. Around 2005, we placed all of Harrison's papers. We took them to a few places. The family decided on Columbia University, where it's got a 102-page inventory, which is available online, something I worked on over the years. And the important things for listeners to know are that I'm currently, in terms of Hubert Harrison, there's volume one of a two-volume biography out on him. My first volume is Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918. That's volume one because he lives another 9 years. We have a Hubert Harrison reader that has 138 articles on Harrison, and I'm in the process of preparing 700 to 800 articles, all his writings, to be put on the Internet, free, worldwide, permanent, searchable database, not getting paid a penny. This is not about money, right? This is, and when the papers were placed at Columbia, the family got all the money. This is because Harrison is a giant of black history and of U.S. history, and he's so important, and he really speaks to people today. One other project currently working on is that book, When Africa Awakes. We're doing a new edition with Diasporic Africa Press, which hopefully will get finished in a few months, and people want to get it into the continent. And, you know, so Harrison is becoming more widely available. I came to him, not that I set out to write on him. I was interested in what he was interested in, and then I came to him. And aside from all these papers that Harrison had, I mean, it was about 40 archival boxes, what's also very important is, and I didn't know this when I first started, because even after the family gave me all the papers, they didn't quite give me everything, right? Because I worked on a dissertation. It was about an 800 dissertation under a fine historian, Nathan Huggins, another historian, Hollis Lynch, right? I was working with them. And when I finished my dissertation, I took Harrison's 75-year-old daughter out to celebrate. We went for a little dinner. And she reached in her bag and she goes, "Here, Jeff, here's one more thing." And she gave me his diary. He had kept a diary all these years. So I knew then it was a major two-volume biography. So the two-volume biography that I'm trying and I'm working to complete will be the first multi-volume biography, I believe, of an Afro-Caribbean, and only the fifth of an African-American behind those of Booker T. Washington, Du Bois, Langston Hughes, and Martin Luther King Jr. So we're really talking about a giant of black history.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, I watched several of your lectures and presentations on Harrison, and every time I learned something radically new that shaped how, you know, reshaped, rather, how I had understood some of the events of the last 100 years.
We can go through some of that if you want.
Yeah.
Would it be all right if I just laid out in brief for listeners who Harrison was, so they'd get a little better feel, or some other way you want to take it?
No, that's exactly what I want. Go ahead. Go ahead. Right here.
Okay. When I usually do the presentations on Harrison, I talk about him as an intellectual and as a political activist, because he was extraordinary in both areas. And I usually begin with the quote from J.A. Rogers in World's Great Men of Color, that Hubert Harrison was the foremost Afro-American intellect of his era and the one with the sanest program. And that quote, I mean, that's he's writing on Harrison amid chapters on Booker T., on Du Bois, on William Monroe Trotter and Garvey. So he's treating him, as I think he should be, as a total giant, right? So, and he raises the question of Harrison, and he subtitles his piece on Harrison, in part, he refers to him as an intellectual giant. So when Harrison comes, he's born in St. Croix. It's Virgin Islands. It was a Danish possession when he lived there. And I talk about that at some length, and I encourage people to look at the biography, get it into your libraries if you can so others can read it, right? And when he comes as a 17-year-old orphan to New York. Right? And he faces the difficulties that so many immigrants face. You know, he's got to make a living. What's he going to do? And he's working 5 days a week and a couple nights, and he manages to go to high school a couple nights. And he, one of the New York Daily newspapers, The World, in 1903, writes a headline article, "Genius Found in West Indian Student." They had never seen anyone like him. He gets citywide honors in Latin and another subject, and he's barely going to school. But very important for Harrison, for listeners, Harrison is an autodidact, like Malcolm later and like so many important people in our history, in black history. He reads all the time, and it was said when he died he read several books a day. Now, I went through all his papers and his books that remained, and I know that he knew how to attack a book. He just wasn't passive with books. He would pick up a book, he'd look at it, and go after what he thought was important and really, you know, get into that. He spoke or read 6 languages, and we get this particularly from his diary, to varying degrees, but included in the languages, in his latter years, he was teaching himself Arabic and reading the Quran, not because he was religious. He became a free thinker, right? But because that was a religion of so many people of African descent, right? He was a pioneer. This is still Harrison as an intellectual. He was a pioneer soapbox orator. He would speak on the street corners on history, science, politics, education, literature, theater, evolution, and constantly on matters of race and class. He was a prolific writer, as I've indicated. He dies at 44. We found 700 to 800 articles by Harrison. He is, as an editor, He was editor in 1911 of the one of the editors of the Masses, which was the leading left literary publication of that decade. But most importantly, in 1917, he becomes editor of The Voice. The Voice is the first newspaper of the new Negro movement, and it's the organ of the Liberty League, which is Harrison's organization, which is the first organization of the Liberty League. Now, The Voice is subtitled A Newspaper for the New Negro. What I want to emphasize is this is 8 years before Alain Locke. Charles, when you're talking before about the history that gets passed on in the schools and stuff, people hear New Negro, Alain Locke, 1925, middle class, arts-based kind of movement. But Harrison founds this New Negro movement in 1917, and it is based in social and political activism, but it also is extraordinarily literary because every paper that Harrison edits has poetry for the people and book review sections. And Harrison, as early as 1907, when he's working in the night shift in the post office in New York, is writing letters to the editor that get published on the front page of the New York Times Book Review, too, when he's a 24-year-old, you know, night shift working postal worker. And to this day, you have scholars, leading critics in the country, members of the National Book Critics Circle, who have quotes from Hubert Harrison on how to review books up on their webpage. So, we've located 70 to 80 book reviews by Harrison, so he really should be being taught in a lot of these literature courses and things. But going on, Harrison in 1919 edits another magazine, The New Negro, a monthly magazine of a different sort, intended as the organ of the international consciousness of the darker races, especially the Negro race. Again, this is 6 years before Alain Locke. In 1920, Harrison edits the book I've mentioned earlier, When Africa Awakes, but the subtitle is The Inside Story of the Stirrings and Strivings of the New Negro in the Western World. All this New Negro movement, years before Locke, right? And then just talking about Harrison as an intellectual again, in 1920, and one of his real lasting contributions, is in 1920 he becomes principal editor of Marcus Garvey's Negro World, and that's when the paper really sweeps the globe. And Harrison is the editor, and in his diary, excerpts of which are in the book A Hubert Harrison Reader, which we have out, the one with his writings, he describes, you know, in exactly what he did stylistically, you know, how he went to shape it and everything like that. It's a major and an important story, I think, in journalism. And he also, in that paper, besides poetry for the people and book review sections, he's also bringing a great international perspective because he's an extraordinary internationalist, and he starts the West Indian News Notes. He gets a lot of writers from Africa submitting. So one more thing, just Harrison is also, I mentioned he does book reviews, he also does theater reviews. And as a critic, when he did, for instance, in the Negro World, in the paper of the Garvey movement, he does a review of the play The Emperor Jones. People may be familiar with Paul Robeson had the lead in it later on, but the first lead was Charles Gilpin, who many considered the leading black actor of the decade of the late teens, early 20s. And when Harrison writes a review of that, O'Neill, who wins the Nobel Prize for Literature in the 1930s, writes to Harrison and says, "This is extraordinary. Any theater I have anything to do with, you have a role in." So that's just a brief overview. And also, I guess I want, let me mention, Harrison was a pioneering black activist in not only the New Negro movement, but in the socialist movement, in the free thought movement, in the birth control movement. He was speaking about birth control in the teens and sometimes being attacked, you know, by the cops on street corners in New York when he did. But he was also doing so with an awareness of certain, you know, genocidal or the implications of, you know, how it can be used against the black community. So he had very good understanding of that stuff, I think. Now, the other aspect of Harrison, just so people at least get their first taste of him if they've not heard about him already, is Harrison as a radical activist. A. Philip Randolph describes Harrison as the father of Harlem radicalism. And he's writing this describing a period when Harlem is considered the center of radical black thought and the international Negro Mecca. And Randolph was following him. Garvey later follows him. Garvey joins Harrison's organization. People familiar with Garvey know he's not one to really join other people's organization, but he joined Harrison's organization. Hubert Harrison is the only person in United States history to play leading signal roles in the largest class radical movement of his day and the largest race radical movement of his day. He was the leading black activist in the Socialist Party. He would speak as many, around 1912, he'd speak as many as 23 times a week. He really pushed the socialists to start addressing what back then was called the Negro question. He's posing it as the key test of socialism. He writes, one of the major insights he offers, which I like to always emphasize to people, is in one of his passages, he writes, this is around 1912, he writes, "The Negro is the touchstone of the modern democratic idea." Now, a touchstone is a black stone. You rub it against the metal to see if it's really the gold that it purports to be. And I think that metaphor is an extraordinary one that we can use today in every area we address in society. If we're looking at housing, education, life expectancy, health care, let's put it to the test. How are black people faring, and what are we going to do about it? And he goes on in that same passage to write, essentially, that true democracy and equality for the Negro, using the word back then, with pride, as he did, he struggled to capitalize it, and he led in that effort way back then. Later on in the 60s, there's a move away from that. But he says, true democracy and equality for the Negro implies a revolution startling to even think of. And I think that is profound. I think it foreshadows what we do see in the 60s, what I talked about earlier, where that civil rights, black liberation struggle is a catalyst for every other movement in this country, the student movement, the labor movement, the anti-war movement, the gay and lesbian rights, the, you know, all these movements, peoples of color, they all take sustenance from the civil rights, black liberation struggle. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why Harrison is so important today, because he really speaks to issues and in a way that we can learn much from today. Just to go on a little with him as a radical activist. So, as I said, he's the major radical influence on A. Philip Randolph, who's a very prominent class radical, and Marcus Garvey, a very prominent race radical. When you take those lines of descent down to the period when I grow up, that's Martin and Malcolm, because it's Martin who marches with Randolph at his side in the March on Washington, and it's Malcolm, whose mother was a reporter for the same Negro World paper that Harrison had been principal editor of. She's writing a few years after Harrison's there, and whose father was a Garveyite preacher. So you see these, he's an important link. I argue in the books I write that he is a key link in the ideological unity, or a key ideological link in the unity of these two great trends in the black liberation struggle. And what I've written in the books is, and no one's really seriously challenged because I think it's accurate, that amongst his generation, Hubert Harrison was the most class-conscious of the race radicals and the most race-conscious of the class radicals. So he's an extraordinary activist. And the thing about his activism, which I think fits in exactly with the work you're doing, is it was very much geared towards the common people, the everyday people, right? And he really emphasized and encouraged people to read. He wrote essays like "Read, Read, Read." He thought free public libraries were one of the great institutions in this country. He was really trying to work it from the bottom up, if you will. And he, so as a radical activist, again, he's just extraordinary. And he's also, as I mentioned, an internationalist, and he writes about that. We can talk about that in a little bit if you would like. I'm sorry if I'm going on too long.
I think we have a few more minutes.
Charles, one more thing, if I may. So just in sum, for Hubert Harrison, his overall appeal is he's race conscious, he's class conscious, he's scientific. As I mentioned, he turns to science to begin to address social problems. He's internationalist. He's common people. That's who he emphasizes. He's a master of the mass approach of his day, soapbox oratory. He's the pioneer soapbox orator in Harlem. He starts that tradition, which we see later in Malcolm and others, right? And he's a great newspaper editor. He's a proponent of direct action. He understands the interrelation between literature and the arts. He's anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, all those things. Two other things, if we're going to pick this up later, but I want to give you a little, because I think they'll be of interest to listeners, is Harrison is really pioneering in the notion of the African dispersion, of Africans of the diaspora, right, and talking about that 1919, 20, and 21. And he has some very insightful things to say on Africa. He really understood his African roots. He writes in 1907, one of his diary entries, he writes as an untamed, untamable African, and writes with great understanding of Africa. Historian Winston James says, of all his contemporaries, Harrison knew more and wrote and spoke more knowledgeably about Africa than all his contemporaries, but he did so without the arrogance that so often comes from people in this country. So there's so many important aspects. But people, as we indicated earlier, if they go to the webpage, there's lots of articles already up on that webpage, which is simply my name, www.jeffreybperry.net. You'll find all kinds of free stuff on Harrison, audio, video, articles.
Perfect. We definitely want to encourage you to go to the website. Check out that website. We're going to put the information up on the community page on Facebook, and we will also create additional dialogue in the future. We really do appreciate you coming and spending this time with us, and hopefully in the very near future we will be able to continue this dialogue, because this is very pertinent information that I think is extremely valuable to our community, and you are very appreciated for what you are doing.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, well, thank you, and folks, for joining us on the African Knowledge Beyond the Book feature. Dr. Jeff Perry, author of Hubert Harrison's biography, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism.
Yeah.